Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White. And today for Beth Ruyek, the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services, or you may hear it referred to as Cal-OES, is constantly preparing to take on the state's next big disaster. This includes being ready to respond at a moment's notice, also coordinating all the other state agencies, and when the immediate terror of an event has passed, helping communities recover. As fire season is now upon us with warnings of excessive heat, this seems like a good time to bring in Cal-OES Director Mark Ghilarducci to talk about the state's growing number of massive wildfires. And then let's not forget the state's other potential threats like floods, mass shooters, and of course, the pending big one, earthquakes. Welcome to Insight, Mark.
Happy to be here. Good morning.
That list is terrifying to most of us, but to you, it's daily conversation.
Well, it is a daily conversation, but nonetheless, very scary events.
And did I describe pretty well what OES does?
You did. Yeah, we're very, very broad organization that really is focused on preparing and protecting the state.
I imagine it evolves, though, and with some of the events we've had in recent years, what have you seen change?
I think in the recent years, first of all, California has always been a disaster-prone state. It's not like we have not had disasters in the past. And it kind of comes through cycles where we get a lot of disasters and then seems to slow down a little bit. But really, since around 2013 or so, we've seen an uptick in very, very major or serious disasters that we've been seeing in the state. And they've been a whole variety of things, from earthquake to flood to, you know, atmospheric river or weather events.
Landslides.
To landslides or mud flows. Obviously, catastrophic wildfire. And then, we had a terrorist attack in San Bernardino, and we've been seeing some other kind of things like active shooters. So there's been a lot of activity in the last few years that we have been dealing with. And then there's the stuff that you don't really see, like, you know, we're continuing to deal with and monitor sea level rise and other kinds of events that are taking place that are climate driven.
So you have, like you mentioned, those immediate events that happen, like an earthquake, and then those slow motion disasters like sea level. What is your agency doing to address the communities that may be most affected by that?
So in the case of sea level rise, really the first thing is trying to get a good assessment on the communities that are going to be impacted. So part of that is mapping the coastal communities and getting a sense on where the current water line is, and then based upon science and working with the geologic surveys and the National Weather Service and NOAA and other organizations projecting where that sea level rise will take place, and then working with communities on mitigation efforts to either buy down that risk to protect the community itself, or possibly in cases where there are going to be development, maybe rethink the development that may take place there.
When does Cal-OES get called into a situation? At what point does it stop being a local response and the state steps in?
Well, it's really always a local response. I mean, all disasters really are local. It happens where people, you know, live and go to work and go to church, et cetera, and go to school. OES is engaged and involved all the time with our local government partners and really with our other state agencies as well. And so we're actually right there at the beginning of an event that takes place. We may not necessarily be fully providing resources at that initial stage. It may be something the local government could handle, but we may be providing technical advice or assisting in some way in a support role. If the event becomes more than what that local government can handle, and of course, events these days have that happens very rapidly, right? We've seen these events grow in size and complexity very, very fast and become multi-jurisdictional, multi-county, multi-region. And so we step in pretty quick. And really, it's really making sure that we get resources committed to that incident early to be able to stay out in front of the disaster. And what I mean by that is as the disaster evolves, as it gets worse, we want to have our resources and our capabilities in place to be able to really mitigate the effects of that expanding disaster.
Mark, how do you stage those resources? Do you look at the state and map it out and say it's likely that a wildfire might strike here, we can expect some flooding there, an earthquake, as we know, along the San Andreas Fault might be likely. So how does the state figure out where to put those resources on any given day?
Well, it's a little bit all of the above. I mean, we have, of course, state assets that are staged in locations throughout the state that are relatively strategic, and they're either in Southern California or central part of the state, or in the north. We also have our equipment that is embedded in local government fire agencies throughout the state. We have agreements. Local government firefighters staff our equipment, and then we can move them out throughout the state. And those pieces of equipment are also staged strategically. We have the state mapped out by region. And, of course, we know, for example, we have hazardous materials and search and rescue capabilities in the high seismic areas, areas where it's going to be a high chemical plant concentration, whereas we have our wildland fire engines and some of our other capabilities in the urban wildland interface. The thing about it is that there's really not a part of California where we all don't depend upon all of the resources for one thing or another. So the key thing is being able to really assess what's happening at the time, good situational awareness, working closely with our partners at CAL FIRE and the California Highway Patrol to be able to get a quick assessment of what's happening, having great relationships with our local governments, communications back and forth, and then our mutual aid systems that are able to provide those resources in a very timely way.
You mentioned that some of these disasters in recent years have crossed county boundaries or jurisdictional boundaries. Several recent high-profile disasters, communication became a problem, either between those counties or between emergency services. And in some cases, residents did not get warnings to leave. I'm thinking about the Tubbs fire, right? Mm-hmm. Very few people were alerted of the approaching disaster. And then in the Camp Fire, the Chico Enterprise Record put it this way last December. They said it was a black hole of communication. And then they say in disasters, our high-tech communities are reduced to 1940s era responses. How does your organization approach the problem of communication when everything's going haywire?
Yeah, it's a great question and a complex one, actually, because, you know, we have 58 counties and a lot of jurisdictions throughout the state. And all of the counties have had historically a communications capability to put out alerts and warnings. And the issue, and in fact, they were used to some degree in both events, both up north in the Camp Fire and then down south in the Woolsey Fire and the Tubbs Fire. But the issue is that they were not used consistently. There wasn't a consistent message that was put out. It wasn't timely enough. And a lot of that was based around inadequate situational awareness and inconsistencies in training across all the counties. So the first thing is that we really looked into this. And last March, we laid out new guidelines for all counties within the state, in essence, standards that we want all counties to be operating under that build in consistent terminology, consistent timeframes, the methodology and the technology that's going to be used to ensure that those messages get out to the public in a timely fashion.
Those are just suggested guidelines, though, right? The counties are under...
Well, I mean, their guidelines were, I mean, we honestly have an expectation that all the counties will adopt them. And it is our indication that all the counties are adopting them. And you know, I think that everybody's looking for that level of guidance. And this is the living document. We're going to continue to evolve those guidelines as technology improves and our ability to send that message out gets better and better. Those guidelines need to be updated accordingly. It's important to note, though, that, you know, we as a society have moved off of landlines, hard lines, and moved into a cellular network sort of system. That's how we get our communication. And the cellular network, the cell sites, it's not a government-run system. It's privately owned, right, and privately managed. And so the key thing is that we can ask the telecommunications industry to ensure that those sites are hardened and resilient to disaster. But in reality, if they go down, then communication can get interrupted. And we have had failures in that system in all of the events that's taken place. So part of this is I would tell people who are listening, you know, this is about personal preparedness and understanding the risks of the area that you live in and being aware of what you're seeing in the conditions, and then having a plan that if you need to get out of an area, if there's a wildfire nearby, or, you know, take the proactive action, call the fire department, find out what's happening to be able to make a decision to evacuate or not.
Mark, in your guidelines that have been suggested to counties, what is the best practice for alerting residents? Because I know that there's been concern that if a mass alert goes out, then it might create an exodus and traffic jams and make it hard for emergency response teams to get to the problem. What are you telling counties to do?
Well, I think that sort of depiction of sending an alert out sends panic really has not rung true, and we have not seen that. We want counties to issue an emergency alert when the time is right.
And what form would that alert take?
Well, we want to send it out. There's a couple different ways. Counties have a way for if you live in a particular county, you can sign up on an alert network and opt in. Although, you know, there's a new law that was put in place last year that really is going to put everybody into a alerting system anyway. You don't have to really opt in anymore.
Like a reverse 911.
Yeah, those are local. Those are commercial. A code red, alert 911. These are all different kinds of systems that counties use, and we want individuals in their respective counties to sign in. They can get a lot of information, but the county also has the ability to use the wireless emergency alert system. That is a federal system that we all participate in. We talk about it in the guideline, and we want the counties to use that as well. That preempts all other emergency alert systems in your phone. If you're traveling through an area, say you're from another state, you happen to be traveling through the area and you're in the polygon or the area that's been designated, you will get that alert. And that is really important, because that way we're maximizing the number of people that will get the alert during that time.
Is it time to bring back sirens like they have, you know, down around Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in San Luis Obispo County? There's a network of sirens that will go off if there's a problem. If the communication networks are going down for various reasons, that would be sort of a last analog resort, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think sirens are, there's a number of communities that are looking at putting sirens back in as a form of alerting. It works in some communities. It does not work in others. And, of course, you have to keep in mind that sirens also come with a significant amount of public education. What does it mean when you hear the siren? Where do you go? What do you do? You know, it is sort of old school technology by comparison to getting, you know, an alert on your phone. People are moving and very active. If you're not by your home and you know you don't hear the siren. However, I will just say that there are communities around the state that are looking at the siren system or updating the sirens that they have in their community.
What can you tell us about the 911 fee included in this week's state budget deal?
Well, the 911 fees is really an important upgrade to the 911 system. You know, let me say that, you know, the 911 system put in place in the early 1970s. The fee was originally based around individuals with landlines. Today, we're getting some 72 million 911 calls throughout the state, principally all over non-landline, so cell phones or OnStars or through the Internet of Things. The fee structure has never been changed in all these years. And we're still on an analog system in most of the system, and it is not a resilient system any longer. We've got outages that are taking place. We've seen outages in these various disasters. We need to build in that redundancy and resiliency. And to do that, we need to upgrade the technology and then move to something we call next generation 911, the ability to text the 911 and move video to 911 and have the infrastructure in our 911 centers resilient enough to withstand these events, these kind of major events that we're seeing today. So it's a very small percentage, something like, you know, 20 to 30 cents that we're talking about to increase in the fee that will will take us into well into the years to come and update our system. And this is really our life-saving system. There's no question about the need to upgrade our 911 system and have it as resilient as possible.
Would you characterize the current system as pretty antiquated?
It is antiquated. I mean, we're using it every day, but I also will tell you that we work very hard to keep it operational.
I think some of us imagine when we call 911 that our call is mapped, and then if a lot of calls are coming in at once, you know, the center can see where the problem is just based on the incoming calls. Is that the case?
In some areas, we've been able to do some beta and build in some capability, but I would not say that is the case throughout the entire system. And, you know, probably, in fact, most of the system is not that way.
Yeah. We're speaking with Mark Ghilarducci. He's the director of Cal OES. Officially, it's called the Governor's Office of Emergency Services.
Right. Yeah, we're part of the Governor's Office, and we're the governor's, public safety emergency services arm, and really it's overseeing and coordinating all of the different aspects of threats and emergencies that could happen in the state.
And Cal OES, with that in mind, has an Office of Access and Functional Needs. Can you tell us how that works?
Right. So when I became the director, we opened up within my office, the Office of Access and Functional Needs, and we have an incredible young man, Vance Taylor, who represents that office, chief of that office. That office is there to engage and interface with the access and functional needs population. So that's a very broad population, but, you know, everything from our aging community to individuals that are homebound or bound to some sort of a mobile device, a wheelchair of some sort.
Which we saw a lot in Paradise.
We saw a lot in Paradise, there's a lot of senior care homes in Paradise and a lot of senior citizens in Paradise, right? And so making sure that that elements in local and state emergency plans address access and functional needs, making sure we have enough resources to address their needs during a disaster. It's not good enough to just open up a shelter to be able to put refugees from a disaster. These individuals require a different kind of shelter, a different kind of bedding system, different kinds of bathrooms and showers. And so we really stepped that up to ensure that those are rapidly provided and in place. And Vance's office is very active across the spectrum of all the disciplines, all the jurisdictions to ensure that the needs of that community are being met.
And that includes the communication need of speaking a common language.
And as well in the guidelines that I talked about earlier, and when we put alert and warnings out, what it means to the people in access. If you're blind or you can't hear, the vibration of your phone or what you're getting, all of that is very important. So we have to think down to the detail of the end user, and that whether that's a person with access functional need or a school child in a school, we want to think through all of it, because really the reason we're here is to address the needs of our constituents.
Right. Following some of the mass shootings that we've seen, you mentioned San Bernardino, and then there was Ventura County more recently. I understand OES is involved in training to help counties deal with these situations?
We are. Our other role besides emergency management is we're the Homeland Security Agency for California. So we have a law enforcement role and our role with regards to ensuring for the overarching security of the state. We implement and carry out the state's Homeland Security strategy. And part of that is training state and local governments and even individuals on issues related to active shooter and counterterrorism and a whole gamut of kinds of things. We've done a lot with schools, being able to work and ensure that schools have the appropriate training for teachers and administrators. And we have a California Specialized Training Institute is our training arm. It's actually, we have a big campus in San Luis Obispo, but we train all over the state. And we put thousands of students through that every year. And that's an all-hazard training area. We train in everything from, earthquake response and recovery and management and all the above through the disasters and then all of our criminal justice programs.
So can you train us right now? I would assume that you believe we should all have a go bag.
Well, everybody should have a plan. Let's start off with that, right? So what does that mean? So that means that you need to, again, get an assessment of where you live. If you're living on an earthquake fault or near one, if you're living in a wildfire area, if you're living next to a levee or a flood, you know, a lot of people in Sacramento live next to levees.
Oroville.
Oroville. It was another event that took place a couple years ago. If you're living next to a chemical facility, you want to do an assessment of where you're at. And then you want to look at things like, if I had to get out, what is my primary evacuation route, secondary and tertiary? I always have three because your first two could be blocked for whatever reason, right? So you want to have a third. Then you want to have, you want to talk with your family or if you're, you know, individual, you want to exercise that. Okay, if I need to get out, let's run these routes. So I know what they look like in the daytime. I know what they look like in the nighttime. And then you want to have a communications plan, which is really based upon having an identified place that your family, if you're separated, can come and get to, or that you can all call into somebody, preferably out of the state or out of the area that you live in, because
unaffected.
The phone system is down. Outside of it, it's probably not, right? So you can all call and say, okay, we're safe. Social media also has capabilities of that. I encourage people in communities to look and see if they've got a neighborhood watch program or My Next Door or something like that that has the ability that the neighbors can share information with each other. And you can pin yourself, I'm okay, on a social media site. And then you need to have some supplies, right? It's not uncommon that you will lose power. We may lose gas service. Depending on the kind of disaster, for several days. And that means that you need to have a capability. You may want to have an emergency generator, but understand that it has to be operated outside and you know how to use it, which means you have to practice all this stuff. So it's an investment that you are taking in your own empowerment.
Insurance.
And it's your own personal insurance. And we have found that the more people do this, the more empowered they are, the better they can withstand the effects of these kinds of events.
Insight producer Helen Barrington says the one thing people forget to put in their go bag is cash, because ATMs will be down.
ATM will be down.
The use of credit cards at grocery stores may not be available. And so there's a little tip from our team.
No, that's a good tip. I mean, you know, there's going to be some basics, medication, some cash. And again, you know, people, you know, I ask people all the time, how much fuel do you have in your car right now? Oh, gosh, it's almost empty. You know, you should try to keep your car at least 50% fuel source, full.
Right.
That's important because, you know, if the power goes out, then your gas stations can't pump fuel.
Oh, true. Right. Mark Ghilarducci, Director of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, or Cal OES. Thanks so much for being on Insight, sharing your knowledge of the state's ability to respond. We have links on our website, capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight. This is your NPR station, Capital Public Radio.